Hi, I'm Kovtás András from Hungary, president of Insert Coin Association, and you're listening to the FinWorld podcast.
Sup, it's the Scene World podcast. I'm Woo! Me, he's him over there. And sure. In a minute, we're going to be talking to Brett Weiss, who is an author and a YouTuber and a big dude in the retro scene. And we've got some cool insights and an excellent interview. We actually just finished it. This is one of the rare occasions when we were doing the intro on the same day that we did the interview.
Exactly, because weird. The month is already almost over, and we want to keep our releasing schedule of 2 episodes per month, so we have to make this quick. Scrambling. But before, though, Scrambling. Some news,
yes.
I'll let Number you start,
one. AJ. Okay, number one, there's this little outfit based over in, I think it's mostly in Germany, but it's a couple other places. There's a disc mag called Scene World. Released a new issue a couple days ago. Let me see if I can find it here. I think it's what was that? 34, yeah. So they've been around for a bit. So that's available.
Guess where I heard the name from.
It's available on the website. You can download it for your C64 or your emulator, or you can even run it right in the web browser. You're welcome. Yes, that's number one.
And also, we have once again a disc cover by a real disc cover artist, Skeletor from Poland, which we didn't have in a while. Let me qualify that,
because a real disc cover artist. Once you've made a disc cover, you are a disc cover artist. Right. So everyone that has done a disc cover for us is a disc cover artist.
Right. But I mean, not people who did it because like, yeah, I want to do it. But he did it before as his primary profession in the demo scene.
Right. Okay. Yes. There you go.
Right.
I just don't want to discount any of the other wonderful people that have done disc covers for us over the past.
No, but let's
39 years.
One of the original disc cover artists for the demo scene. Yeah.
There you go.
Obviously. Yeah, before we had people from external that were not part of the demo scene doing them. Some were done by our own.
I always liked the ones that were done by people that were not necessarily seen people that were just kind of, because it's cool to see what people that are not in this, you know, how they figure out what a disc cover should look like. That's pretty awesome.
Right.
Ishida did awesome. I loved her disc covers. She's amazing.
Right.
So that's number one piece of news. Second piece of news is, we talked to a few years back, Misty Tech, who is doing, you know, they use Myst, the MMORPG, MMORPG.
Right. I remember the horror of recording that and getting everybody connected on the same interview.
Oh, we had to do it twice. Yeah, we had to.
Yeah, we actually had to do it twice because we couldn't get everybody on the same call.
Yep. The limitations of Skype.
No, it was actually not a limitation of Skype. It was a limitation of the team being scattered all around. The only limitation that we had is you only had 4 video streams at a time. So it would swap the 5th video around.
Right. That's what I mean, though, is the limitation of like having, you know, the video kind of walky. But so they're doing it's called The Lost Art. Okay, let me try that again. You need to fix that because I don't want to make it seem like I don't know what they're called. So there's a project called The Lost Art, which is an ongoing episodic kind of it's a production, you know, like you know, with scripts and acting. I'm one of the actors. I do voices for this one. And they have released their newest episode. It is called The Good Red One. It's available on their YouTube page. So check it out. It's pretty awesome. You might need to kind of go back and watch some of the other ones to understand what's going on. It's a pretty involved thing. It's a very kind of they've worked on story, like they've worked on background and story and character development. They put a lot of effort into this. So,
oh yes, I remember when after the interviews we recorded with them, they actually made a premiere of the full episode, and that was a whole undertaking.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God!
But you sat in
the call, right? Yeah.
But you've sat in on the recording. So have I sat in on them actually recording it, where they're in the MMORPG in the game, and you gotta. They're building the scenery in there and moving the people around and setting up camera angles and lighting. It is more complicated than I mean, that's one thing that I would have loved to have been able to do, but I just don't have the brain power to do it. You know, they did ask if I would do a voice, and I do a voice for them, which is pretty awesome. I love that. But yeah, the I'd love to have been able to, you know, kind of get into the whole, like, you know, acting part of it, you know, moving the characters and stuff. But I'm not good enough a puppeteer to manage it. Right. But so that is out. The Good Red One is the new episode. It's 22 minutes long. It's on the Misty Tech Productions YouTube page. We will put a link in the podcast description so you can check it out. And that's my news. Is what you got, sis?
Well, what I've got is the Winamp player is now available on the mobile version for iOS and Android.
So if Winamp is on iOS and Android, is it still Winamp?
It's still Winamp, yeah.
Is it not iOS amp or Android amp?
No, it's Winamp. Despite it's not in Windows, it's
because I used to have Mac amp on my Mac. It's just like Winamp, but it was a Mac version.
I had a Linux version, or it was still called Winamp.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, which is interesting because, as we all know, it was once owned by Nullsoft, which was a brand of AOL. Nullsoft,
yes.
Yeah, which was actually a brand of AOL.
Mm-hmm.
And now, from what I understood, they are independent and they are back. Well, I mean, they are back since 2 years already. And they took this long to make the mobile version. So anyway, it's pretty nifty, pretty wild.
Mm.
Well, other news, David Pleasance, which we had a couple of times on the podcast in the historical interview section, is working with Dave Haney, which we also had in the historical interview section, on a new book with Dare to Dream, Commodore and Amiga Today. So yes, they are dreaming up what would have happened if Commodore didn't fold in 1994 in USA. And 1996 in Germany.
And why haven't we talked to them on the podcast about this new project?
Because I didn't know in time, and we didn't have the time because we had to concentrate on Gamescom.
Okay.
That's the two reasons. It's good reasons.
Yeah.
but as I know,
maybe you'll catch them at Gamescom though, and that'll be a podcast.
Or afterwards. I mean, as I know David Pleasance, if the crowdfunding is successful, it will probably turn into a normal publishing book. But they still have, of this day of recording, 6 days left, and they still need 35% of the original funding.
Mm-hmm.
That means people, help. Don't hesitate. Yeah. Well, David wrote an update today saying it's probably going slow because of the current financial situation of everybody and a lot of people losing their jobs and stuff. That could be.
Yeah. Could be.
And also what was announced today by Nocon, one of those big French publishers.
Right.
There is a limited edition that you can now pre-order of the new Test Drive Solar Crown, which is available for Xbox, PlayStation, and PC with a physical version. So you can either buy the collector edition without the game itself or with the game. And if you order it now and also subscribe to the newsletter, you get 10% off. That means right now the game costs 240 euros. You wonder why euros, why not dollars? Because France uses euros. So even for the Americans, it's a euro price, not a dollar price.
Right.
So now, if you calculate 10% off, that means you are saving 24 euros off your limited collector's edition with the game included.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's pretty nice.
Yeah.
And that would be my three pieces of news that I have for today.
Well, all right.
Then let's move to...
let's hop over to this, the quickest intro ever. And we'll pop on over.
I guess last one was pretty quick, too. I guess the last one was like 10 minutes or something.
But it's a good interview, so we don't want to waste time talking about nonsense. So let's hop right into it.
Today we have another guest, and... today we have Brett Weiss. Hello, Brett.
Hey, how's everybody doing?
Good, I hope. Yes, well, so I invited you because I found we are basically kind of in the same battle, same bubble, I would say. And the way you came into the picture for me basically was when I saw an article that... now I forgot the name. Now it slipped my mind. Dragster, right?
Oh, Dragster, Activision game for the Atari 2600.
Exactly. And it was who was the guy again? Who?
Todd Rogers.
Todd Rogers, right? Yeah. Todd Rogers. Todd Rogers. And I've read an article about you and Todd Rogers where you have been in a convention. And Todd Rogers, while you have been in the toilet, signed all your VCS cartridges of the game, right?
Yeah, I was at Classic Game Fest in Austin, and I've known Todd Rogers for a long time because we went to the Classic Gaming Expo. I met him there in Las Vegas years ago and had talked to him a few times over the years. And he was at Classic Game Fest in Austin, and I had my booth there. And while my son was watching the table and I went on a restroom break, he came up and signed both copies of my Dragster cartridge because he was the supposed world record holder.
Right.
And he just signed that without me knowing or anything. I guess he thought he was doing me a favor. But it turned out well because so I sold one of them. So for starters, I kind of wanted to be mad because that was kind of an invasion, you know, writing on my stuff without... consent. And but you know, Todd's a nice guy. I think his heart was in the right place, and he I think he meant well. But so I just let it slide. I said, hey Todd, what's up and everything. Well, I actually sold one cartridge, but then I had that one left over. Well, then I guess a couple of years or more later, you know, there was the big publicity surrounding his high score and the authenticity of it or lack thereof. And I had that cartridge left over. And so I put it up on eBay and ended up selling it for several hundred dollars to the guy that directed the video game documentary Bits of Yesterday. He bought it from me. So it turned out pretty well for me, you know. So Todd actually did me a favor.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I mean, with our guests, usually we should start at the beginning, and that is How did you get into retro gaming? What was your first touching point? That probably must be way back for you.
Well, the first time I actually started really discovering video games was around 1975. At like bowling alley and skating rinks, there would be arcade games and electromechanical machines and pinball machines. I distinctly remember Midway's Gunfight and a bunch of different pinball machines and some of the electromechanical racing games and some of the little baseball games where you'd actually manipulate a bat to hit a physical ball up into targets, you know, in the outfield. And so then the 76, my two best friends each had a Fairchild Channel F system, a console with cartridges, the system that predated the Atari 2600 by approximately a year. You know, the first system that came to market that actually had programmable cartridges. And it just so happened the kid that lived next door to me, he was one of my best friends. And then a kid that lived about a mile and a half from me, or about a mile, had a Fairchild Channel F, which was just a bizarre coincidence because that wasn't a very popular system. And they're really the only two people I knew that had one back then, but they each had one. And I thought it was magical. I thought it was amazing to be able to go to their house and play these video games on their television set with, you know, without having to pop in quarters. And actually before that, Christmas of 1975, when we were at my cousin's house, we went over there right after Christmas and my cousin invited me and my brother back into his room. And he's, you know, say, look what I got for Christmas. And it was Atari Pong. And at that point, I had no idea you could play video games in somebody's house. I thought you had to go somewhere, like an arcade or a skating rink or something. I didn't know you could play video games at home. I wasn't aware of the Magnavox Odyssey from 72. I had never heard of that, never saw a commercial for it. Nobody I knew had it. And so it blew my mind in 75 when I saw that you could play Pong at home. So, yeah, all the way back then, and I've been at it ever since.
Nice little reference to Ive Bear slipped in.
Yeah. Oh yeah, Ralph Bear. He's I never met him, but I did. I was at a convention one time where he was on a Skype call and did a panel of sorts that way, talking about the brown box, right. You know, the invention of video games on a television set and all that stuff. So yeah.
Yeah. Well, you are talking to the guy who was the last that interviewed him. A few months before he died. Yeah. I didn't know at that point that I would be the last person. But I noticed it when the German gaming press picked it up as a story. Like, yeah. The last person who spoke to Ralph Baer is actually a retro activist, they called me.
Retro activist
from Germany was the last person who spoke to Ralph Baer. You know, yeah.
Well, that's nice that you were able to do that.
Yeah, that's actually true. As it's also kind of sad, but I know people were a bit skeptical when I said I'm planning to interview a 91 years old man. The first question was like, "Is he sane still?" And I well, hopefully, yeah.
Yeah, I think he was pretty sharp. Throughout his, I don't think he, you know, I really wasn't familiar with his condition the last few months or anything.
Yeah.
How long ago did he die after the interview?
Pardon?
How long did he die? Like you interviewed him. How much longer did he live after that?
Probably half a year or something. Hmm. Yeah.
It was a good interview. He seemed he had all his wits about him and stuff.
Yeah, perfect.
Long interview.
Yeah, one hour.
He was very sharp. You know, I saw him pretty late in his life. Or, you know, I'd seen him on different things and him making comments and things pretty late in his life. He definitely still sharp.
Yeah. I mean, I understand it. I mean, I interviewed quite a few people in their late 80s. I mean, just because you're older doesn't mean you are less sharp.
Right. It varies from one person to the next, for sure.
Exactly. Yes. Well, so that is actually... That actually was your starting point. So how did it turn into a profession? I mean, we spoke a bit earlier on Facebook, and from what you told me, I understood that you used to do it freelance full-time, and now you don't do it full-time anymore. Review writing stuff and so on, right?
Yeah, I was a freelance writer for about 25 years. I wrote for the local newspaper, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, pretty big metropolitan newspaper. I wrote for them steadily. I was a journalist, and I wrote for a bunch of different magazines and newspapers. And how I got into that was, so I basically kept current with each gaming generation, you know, throughout. And like in 77, several of my friends got Atari 2600s. My cousin got an Odyssey 2. And then I knew people that had Intellivision, and I would go to their houses and play the games. And then in 82 Christmas, I got a ColecoVision. And then I just kept gaming, and I started collecting in the 80s. Had a pretty massive game collection by the late 80s. And, you know, you could, I also was interested in writing and reading, and my mom would take me to used bookstores, and I just sort of combined my interests in books and writing and video games. And I really liked reference books. Like my parents had encyclopedia set and a science encyclopedia set. I would read those. I would flip through dictionaries, the Guinness Book of World Records. I like books about, like, I've got a book on the 100 most influential people of all time, things like that. I just like reference books and rankings and lists and stuff. And so I sort of combined my interests in reference books with video games and created the Classic Home Video Games series of books. And the first one came out in 2007. And prior to that, in the 1990s, I was writing some short fiction, and that never really took off. I had some stuff published in small press magazines, but then in late 97, I started writing for the All Game Guide, allgame.com. My brother-in-law had sent me a want ad, like a classified ad for people. It was a company. They're still online as the All Music Guide, but they had the All Game Guide from like 97 to around 2000 something. I don't remember when they shut down. I quit writing from around 2000, probably three or so. But anyway, I wrote for the All Game Guide, allgame.com back then. You can find them on the Wayback Machine online. But I started writing for them in late 97, and that sort of snowballed into writing for the Comics Buyer's Guide and writing for the Antique Week, which I still write for, and a bunch of other publications. So yeah, it kind of really started coming together in the late 90s when I got the All Game Guide and the Comics Buyer's Guide. And you know, I like me some guides. And now I like omnibus books and Classic Home Video Game series. And you know, I started when I was writing for the All Game Guide, they were going to put out a book series. And I thought that was really cool. And they were going to have me as one of the contributors. And we'd actually already started on it. And we were going to use some of the stuff off the website as part of the book series. Well, after 9/11, All Game Guide really reduced what they were doing. They let go all their offsite writers. They were in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I'm in Texas, and they scaled down what they were doing, and they let me go. And so I thought, well, they were going to do some reference books, you know, complete console libraries. I'll just do it myself, you know. So I started the Classic Home Video Games book series, and the first book covered the 2600, 7800, 5200, ColecoVision and Television, Odyssey 2, and then some of the lesser-known systems like the Vectrex and the Bally Astrocade, Arcadia 2001, Adventure Vision, and on and on. And so that Classic Home Video Games series, I did that for a while. Then I did the omnibus books and the 100 greatest books, like this one. This was the first 100 greatest book, came out in 2014. Just compiling the 100 best of a decade, 77 to 87. And then I did the decade after that. And so, yeah, I'm still writing. It's just not a full-time gig like it used to be, because a lot of the publications I wrote for are no longer in business, because so much of what people read is just online now. And so many of the print publications that I used to write for are long gone. And even some of the online outlets I used to write for don't pay as well as they used to, because it's a different market. It's harder to write. And as I got older, I thought it'd be nice to have a job with, you know, benefits and overtime and vacation and all that. So I got a regular day job, and I've been doing that for about almost three years now. So it's, but I still write when I can. I write like sometimes in the evening, maybe a little bit on the weekend. So I like to keep some, you know, I'll do occasional article for Antique Week or Old School Gamer Magazine. I keep a blog, BrettWeissWords.com. Still do some write-ups there. So yeah, I'm still writing.
Let's not forget the Encyclopedia of Kiss.
Yes, that was a pure, thank you for that. That was a pure labor of love, because, again, 75, that's when I discovered not only video games, I discovered Kiss with Kiss Alive, an amazing, the big live album that was their big breakout album that really put them on the map. And I've been a Kiss fan ever since, especially 77, 78, when they were just hugely popular. I was obsessed with the band. I would get my dad to take magazine pictures to work and print out photocopies of the little pinup posters, and I was hand those out at school like I was some kind of Kiss evangelist or something. And I remember seeing Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park, the movie on TV, and just being so excited for that and going to their concerts and stuff. So yeah, I've always been a hardcore Kiss fan, and I was reading their autobiographies, and it occurred to me that no one had ever written a Kiss encyclopedia, even though so many other bands, like the Grateful, every other big band, all of them, the Dead, the Stones, the Beatles, the Who, every single iconic band had a full-blown encyclopedia, A through Z, except for Kiss. For some reason, no one had ever done one, so my publisher really liked the idea. And a couple of years later there, had an encyclopedia of Kiss, and Gene Simmons even tweeted the book at one point.
Nice.
And all he said was, with a picture of it sitting on a FedEx package. So either a fan sent it to him, or he or his manager or assistant or whatever ordered it. Because, you know, he's a Kiss collector. He wants everything that's Kiss related.
Right.
And somehow either a fan or he or somebody had that sent to his house, and he just posted it on Twitter with a picture of it. So, like, because it's an independent project. It wasn't an official Kiss project. Right. So I was like, awesome. Oh, what's going on here?
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. I mean, when it comes to writing game books and history books and reviews about games, I've noticed that in the last years, there always have been a discussion about whether how much of the game you should play to write about it, and whether you should use real hardware or emulator for the experience. Well,
I do just capsule reviews, you know, just little synopses. You get kind of a gist of the game. So if it's a simple game, you know, 20, 30 minutes with a game, if it's just something really simple. If it's a more in-depth game, I'd recommend playing it for a longer time. I have no problem with emulation, because if you think about it, a lot of these really comprehensive books that go into all the rare stuff, most people that are reading these books are going to be playing the game through emulation anyway. So to me, it's no problem using emulation, you know. So I have no problem with that, especially with the 100 greatest books. Those are deeper dives. But for the omnibus books and the classic home video games books, where you've just got like a paragraph on the game, you know, as long as you got a general gist of the game, what it's basically about, and if you liked it or not, you know, that covers it. And I will quote other sources, so it's not just my opinion. And I have contributing writers that will throw in nostalgic stories and that kind of thing. And for the 100 greatest books, the second one, they wrote some essays. So yeah, it's kind of a lot of my books are a collaborative effort, which is great, because you get, and I'm the project editor. And so you get kind of my voice throughout, but you get some different opinions and some different ideas and things too. And some nostalgic stories, just some people discovered these games later. Some people, you know, their parents would take them to the rental store back in the 90s when I was, you know, already, you know, doing my, you know, getting married and having kids and stuff. So you get a childhood perspective from other people of different ages. So you get a wide variety of views of the omnibus books in particular.
Right.
So yeah, I have no problem with emulation.
Right. I've never known about Traxler before I read Traxler. about the Todd Rogers story, because yeah. My starting point was the Commodore 64, so
yeah,
I never really had.
Some people don't realize in the U.S. the Commodore 64 came out the same year and the same month as the ColecoVision, August of 1982, and so yeah, those were both, you know, groundbreaking systems. And to this day, the Commodore 64 is the number one best-selling specific iteration of a computer ever. You know, not, you know, you could say the PC, but there's been all these clones and iterations. But right. The actual same model of a computer, the Commodore 64, is the number one selling computer of all time.
Right. To coin a bit back on this Traxler record, whether there is or not a record from Todd Rogers regarding this game. The interesting story is actually how I got involved with the story was that I knew the person who was responsible for making the news blog of Twin Galaxies at that time. And on his personal Facebook, he asks, do any of my friends on Facebook know anybody who works or worked at Activision? And I was like, yeah, I know the coder of Trackster, David Crane. I can put you in touch with him. And so that is how the article actually came to fruition, where David Crane, the coder of Trackster, said, yeah, it's very well possible that the record from Todd Watchers on Trackster isn't fake.
Yeah, I'd seen that. That David Crane supported Todd because he said it was possible that he got that score. And I guess I guess David would know. You know, I don't know that much about the details or the the programming or the intricacies of whether that score was possible or not. But I remember David Crane, creator of Pitfall, backed him up.
And I know AJ discussed with me because as a coder, he probably didn't know what was possible. So we actually had a discussion about that.
Coded the game doesn't mean you're any good at playing it.
That's true.
Yeah, and I mean, the story doesn't even end there. In a few years after that, or a few months after that, Todd Rogers suddenly appeared on the Ben Heck show and tried to prove with Ben that the score is possible, but they totally failed on that. I was like,
he wasn't able to do it.
Yeah, I was like, holy moly. So I don't know if I was Todd, I would have tried to not make a buzz about it and let the story fade out. But no, he was trying to prove it. So,
well, maybe he just wasn't as good as he used to be.
That's another point of view. But the problem is that some people from the Twin Galaxies community actually made tool-assisted programs that proved that it is from the code not possible to get that score. So.
Yeah, I remember reading about that and thinking it seemed fishy.
Yeah, so I'm kind of to blame that I made it possible to start this discussion from on the front blog of Twin Galaxies, because I put them in touch with David Crane. And it turns out that a few weeks later, he actually was fired from the job because Chase Hall didn't like it. Yeah, so, well, but you never know what happens.
Drama.
Yeah.
Yeah, I try to avoid drama when I can. I don't typically put up, you know, these drama type videos. I mean, if I have an opinion on something, I might produce the video, but I try not to get too caught up in all of it.
Let's talk about the Amico.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. If somebody has a question about the Amico, or am I supporting it, or am I being excited about it, I'm always happy to answer it, because I've been honest about the situation all along, just my feelings. You know, I started playing in television, and it was either late 79 or early 80. You know, it was test marketed in 79 and came full release in 1980. And I go back, you know, the first time I played it, my girlfriend had one, her dad had one, and he would have his friend over and they would play the sports games and would just laugh and go crazy over it. Seemed really cool. So we played it. It was fun. And then just a few months later, the next year, I discovered like Astro Smash and some of the space games. And those really, enjoyed those a lot. And those really made me a television fan. And I've been a fan all along. I just thought I love the idea of retro reimagined. I thought it would be cool to have a modern day remakes of these cool games like Astro Smash. And, you know, even, you know, no matter what you ask Tommy, he would say, oh yeah, you know, we'll do that at some point, you know. And I knew that all along that he would, you know, was definitely had hyperbole and everything. But I thought the system would come out at some point early on. You know, a lot of people did, because it seemed somewhat feasible, and it seemed like, you know, this is a guy that had some success in the video game industry and that, you know, had the video games live stuff. And he seemed passionate about the project. And boy, was it mishandled. And I think early on, he was sincere early on and intended to do it. But I think he mismanaged it so poorly, put the cart before the horse, spent way too much money on merch and offices and employees way before he had a way to make money or any kind of real good plans in place. So true. I think he just botched it so bad, and he was afraid to admit he had botched it and just stubbornly kept at it, where it just became a train wreck.
Yeah, I never got the impression from that he was trying to scam anyone or that he was, you know, dishonest about anything. It was something he really wanted to do, and just kind of things, you know, sometimes it stuff happens, and you know.
Yeah, and he got in too deep, where he was really, you know, it wasn't a scam at the beginning, but as people say, it kind of became a scam later when he knew that certain aspects of it weren't going to be like he would carry the story forward when we knew there were holes in the story.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so it became a problematic for sure. And anyway, that was a big debacle, and I hated that happened, because it created a lot of bad blood between people and everything. So it was unfortunate, but I kept up all my Amico videos are still on my YouTube channel, just under my name, Brett Weiss. I kept them on there because I had sincere feelings throughout, you know, and I had nothing to, you know, no reason to pull down any of them, because that's how I felt along the way. And then up and, you know, later I talked about when I canceled my pre-order, I talked about mistakes they made, you know, trying to bring the console to market. I talked about, you know, some perceived mistakes, some real, you know, some definite mistakes and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I wasn't, I tried to be objective about it, even, you know, as far as someone that was, you know, a big Intellivision fan growing up could be.
I mean, Phil Adams still trying to get it done, right?
I guess it's whatever, you know, remnants are left, he's trying to do something with it.
It's so messed up now, because
of really, you know, at this point, I kind of liked it in its original incarnation, you know, with the cool controllers and the $180 and the physical media and all that. The thing it's become now, I don't care too much about.
Right. Yeah. I was going to say.
You said it became such a mess, and then you were interrupted.
Oh, no. I was saying that, like, at this point, you know, in television, what, was Atari on them now or something?
Atari.
So it's like there's like a licensing thing going on now where they're allowed to use some of the names of games, but some people are still saying they're going to release something. Others are, I'm hearing that it's going to be like an online service, you know, where you can download these games, and it's like,
barely pay attention to it at this point. If something big comes out, I'll pay attention, but I'm not even that interested in all the details. I think I got wore out on the whole thing.
Right.
I'm still trying to get Phil Adams on the podcast talking about his plan. So
good luck.
But he's always in quiet time whenever I try to ping him. And I'm like, quiet time, that must be an American thing, you know.
Yeah, he just has the occasional press release, and that's about it. Yeah.
Exactly. So who knows whether this will ever happen or not? I mean, can we talk about the other stuff I heard about you, or is it a no-go? Because I mean,
all the stuff about how awesome I am and stuff. You know,
yeah.
especially about your contribution to other books from other creators. I mean,
yeah. I'll be happy to talk about it.
I saw your statement videos, and interestingly, after I heard the details and his videos and your videos about the story of Pat the NES Punk, how you have been part of his books, and in the reprint you have been eradicated from the books, I was like, man, what a weird situation. I don't know. But that was like my impression.
Was perfectly within his right to delete my reviews from his book. I've never had a problem with that at all. I just didn't like the way he went about it. I wish it would have been handled better.
Exactly.
And I can tell you how it went down. It's just, you know, it wasn't a huge deal at first, but it got a little crazy. it kind of blew up into something that I try to avoid, because I don't like drama, and I like to, you know, be pretty chill, and I really try to get along with everybody. And but what happened was, I saw a solicitation a few years ago online or somewhere, and I'm sure it was online, but I don't remember which website. It I don't know if he had posted it on Facebook or something. Anyway, it was about a third edition of his NES guidebook, and with 60 all new rewritten reviews. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. I wrote about 60 reviews and reflections for his NES guidebook.
Hmm.
And I thought, that's interesting. And so I reached out to him on Facebook. I said, 60 all new rewritten reviews. I said, does this mean what I think it means? And he didn't respond. And I thought, well, that's odd. And so when the third volume came out, I looked at a convention. I picked up a book and thumbed through it. And my reviews were gone, which is, again, I want everybody to know it's perfectly fine when it's completely his project. It's completely his books. Had no problem at all. Just a little heads up would have been nice, because at that point, I was using that as a part of my resume. As a writer, you're constantly pitching newspapers, magazines, conventions, who you are, the idea you have for a panel or an article or a book or whatever. And my inclusion in Pat's NES guidebook was part of that. Mm-hmm. And so if suddenly the people see that NES guidebook, the third edition, and I'm not in it anywhere, they're going to say, well, Brett lied. He's not in here. He was padding his resume with lies. And so, but if he just would have given me a heads up and said, hey, man, I'm coming out with a new version of this book, and I don't like, you know, I want to keep our books separated, because when my omnibus books came out, I don't think he was too thrilled with those, because they're the large hardcover, full color books. And he probably saw that as competition, which is perfectly fine. He said, if you just would have reached out to me and said, hey, I want to keep our project separate, you know, and all that kind of stuff, so I'm going to replace your reviews, that's perfectly fine. And he paid somebody to rewrite all of that. So it was definitely important to him to have all those reviews completely rewritten. And he said the reason he took them out, he would talk about it on his podcast and say, because my reviews, my write-ups were garbage. And so
exactly, said, exactly. That's the point where I said, like, you are known in the field. I mean, it's not like you are nobody, and he just goes around and say, like,
to have it in two editions of the book, you know, I mean, if they were garbage, they shouldn't have made it in the first place.
Yeah, and they were in the second edition of the book,
right?
And which he said was because he was on a deadline and had to get a new book out for conventions,
right?
And it's kind of silly anyway. Right. And I've got, if you go to brettweisswords.com and just look up some of the Pat Contry write-ups or some of the blog posts, I show receipts. I show messages between us where he said, hey, great job. You're a big, you know, a backbone of this project, you know, great job. And he had some suggestions throughout the editing process. He rejected a few of my reviews, which is perfectly fine. He's the project editor. Mm-hmm. And ones that he didn't think were quite up to snuff, he rejected some of those, which is fine. And he had me beef up some I had written, you know, with more details, a little more critique and everything. And so I would, you know, do some rewrites and stuff. It was a really good working relationship. We would talk on the phone. We would text one another, and we would see each other at conventions and everything. And it was all cool until my omnibus book's coming out. And it could be a coincidence, but the timing of him starting to talk negatively about me on his podcast, and for him to start dissing me and stuff and talking about my reviews being garbage, were around the time my omnibus books started coming out, and maybe he saw me as a competitor or what, or anything. But, you know, like I said, I try to get along with everybody, and I typically do. And I thought we had a good working relationship instead. And then it just got weird. And so, yeah, that's the bottom line is he just, I mean, everybody has a different viewpoint when a series of events happen, depending on what perspective you have. But so maybe his viewpoint's different or whatever. But anyway, we had a good working relationship until the omnibus books, SNES Omnibus was the first one, and then SNES Omnibus Volume 2. And I don't think he liked seeing those because they bid his Super Nintendo book to the punt, you know, out on the market. Mm-hmm. And Jeff Wittenhagen's, you know, full color NES guidebook, coffee table book came out before Pat's NES book. Yeah. Leonard Herman's ABC to the VCS came out before any of my books. So I don't have any kind of like jealousy or any kind of gatekeeping.
Exactly. I mean, we are all in the same retro bubble. It's
right. Yeah. Yeah. It's not that big of a field. We talk to people with other podcasts. They're not competitors. You know, we talk about the same thing, but.
And most people I deal with, like every other retro gaming author I've dealt with, you know, Jeremy Parrish, Patrick Hickey, Jeff Wittenhagen, Art of Atari, Tim Lapatino, all these guys, you know, have really great, get along really well, and we've promoted each other's work. I've written for some of their books. They've written for some of my books. I promote their projects. They've promoted mine.
Exactly. Yeah. Why not? Yeah.
Yeah. And it's all been, you know, and I don't wish Pat ill will or anything. I hope he, you know, I think maybe he sees the worst in people sometimes or is suspicious something, yeah, I guess. Yeah. I don't know. But I hope all this is, I've kind of put all this behind me. But I'm
not now bring it up again. I'm
yeah,
sorry.
That, yeah.
No, I really don't mind you bringing it up to clarify, because some people don't know the whole story and don't know really how it went down. But one more thing about the whole seeing my reviews as garbage. If he didn't like my reviews, that's fine. If in retrospect, maybe for some reason 3 years later, he's looked at these reviews, hey, these aren't great, and the backbone like I thought they were, suddenly they're not good. Even if he thought all that. Whatever, take him out. Just be professional about it. Give me a heads up. And
exactly, it's funny that's because the point.
Yeah. It's not like we're writing Merck's medical manual. This is right. Game stuff. This isn't rocket science. These are short reviews. You know, like in the NES guidebook, each game just has one half a page. So you're getting like a synopsis, some critiques and stuff. And this is obviously not rocket science. And if you'll read the first edition of Pat's NES book, the one where I'm still in it, if you look all through it. The writing style, the writing quality, it's all roughly the same. I mean, my reviews aren't greater than anybody else's. Theirs aren't any better than mine. It's just writing about games. It's pretty simple stuff. You know, we're not dealing with, you know, curing cancer here.
Right, right. Yeah, that's exactly the point, being professional about it. And that is actually where I think Pat lacks in that department, because he not only spoke bad about your book, but also about other people's project that were in the roughly same field of stuff he was doing. And it appears that he wants people to think that his books and the stuff he's doing is superior from anybody else's, which is like, I don't know. Doesn't really put a good light on him. Just my opinion.
Well, let's just say he's competitive.
Yeah.
Put a positive spin on it. He's competitive.
Exactly. Yes. So if you say, yeah, invite him, why not? It's your decision. I don't think he would even reply to my email, because after after I saw the pieces about your books, I was like, he is so full of himself. He would never come on, because, you know.
Well, when his NES guidebook was up, I put his entire Kickstarter on my website. And even later, when his Super Nintendo, before the weirdness and the trash talking, when his Super Nintendo book got successfully funded on Kickstarter, you know, I sent him a personal message congratulating, which he didn't reply.
Yeah.
And, it got strange and strained, and just, I guess he just started with, I really think it's just when the omnibus books started coming out. See, my first classic home video game books, these were black and white. They didn't have screenshots. They were just basic encyclopedia sets. Just a, you know, hey, what is Demon Attack? So boom, I can look it up. I can see the differences between the Intellivision and the Atari 2600. What, just basic guides like Leonard Herman's ABC to the VCS. That's the book that inspired me in part to do these classic home video games books. Mm-hmm. And so those were basic as far as production went. Well, you could see the way the industry was going, hardcover, full color, screenshots, people were expecting this. So that's when I switched publishers. I did my 100 greatest book, the first one I showed you guys, 2014. Then I started the omnibus books. That's just the way. I mean, when my first book came out in 2007, there weren't that many retro gaming books on the market. You know, Leonard Herman, Van Burnham, there were a few. There were some Nintendo histories. There was a few others, but there really weren't very many. Well, it's gotten a very crowded, huge market recently, and different publishers. As a matter of fact, McFarlane Publishers, who did my classic home video game series, my first classic home video games book in 1987 or 19 in 2007, when my first classic home video games book came out, covering 72 through 84, that book was the very first video game book McFarland had published. They'd done like a computer book before, but this was the first video game book specifically that they had done. Well, now McFarland has an entire wing, an entire branch of video game books. And a lot of friends of mine that I've known through, you know, retro gaming cons and stuff now have video game books published through McFarland. And quite a few of those authors have reached out to me as a, you know, as a, like, for contact information and for reference. And I was happily, you know, gave them that information and everything, because the books have never been my primary source of income or like my some big ego thing. You know, it's cool and I like it and it's fun to get recognized and it's nice to have it, but it's never been like the basic of, you know, money-wise, being a journalist paid better because you're working every day, you're getting articles right. published all the time. A book is once every couple of years, you know, and then once your initial sales, it slows down after that. But I've had other things that way. And then I've got the wife and the kids and all this other stuff to deal with. So the books right. are just part of all that. Or they haven't been, you know, my only thing or whatever. And so I try not to take it all that seriously because it's a fun hobby. I try to keep it fun. And but yeah, it got unfortunate to where it was like that. But in general, I get along with just about everybody in retro gaming. I've met some of the coolest, most interesting and most intelligent people I've met through retro gaming at these conventions. People that are super savvy tech wise, much more so than me in that sense. I am not a techno guy. I'm a writer. I'm a decent writer and I know grammar and all that stuff and history, but I am not a technology guy. I have to rely on my wife for all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I've met brilliant people, some of the coolest, most interesting people through retro gaming. And I get along with almost everybody, but unfortunately, something like the Amiga will come up or Pat's whatever he was doing. So yeah, but overall, though, it's been a super positive experience.
It's interesting that
Wait one second. This fly keeps landing on my mic. Every time he does, I light up because it's picking him up.
Okay.
I don't know why. He's driving me nuts.
I didn't even notice that.
It might be that fly.
I've been watching him in the video. He lands on it. He walks around, and then he takes off and lands on it again. Now he's not there. As soon as we start talking again, he's going to land on it again.
I know, problem. Yeah.
I start thrashing around. That's just ignore me.
just wanted to say, it's interesting that you mentioned that your wife is the tech person in the household, yes?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, she just, it's very intuitive for her. Like, I'll have a computer question, or there's some, like, even when I was writing for the All Game Guide, I was back in late 90s and early 2000s, you know, they would say, hey, we want you to be the editor for all these different old consoles, like the Odyssey 2. We want you to be the editor for this system and that system. So they had all these new things. I would show her, hey, what does this mean? Look at this. And, hey, you know, it's time to, I should probably get an iPhone at this point, you know, well, how do I do this? You know, so she's always the one to help me out if I have any kind of technological difficulties or questions.
Interesting. I wonder, by the way, what is your personal opinion, if I may ask, about this cheating thing? I mean, it's not only about Todd Rogers, but it's also about Billy Mitchell, for example. HJ has the contrary opinion to me, where I think that probably Bill Mitchell knew what he was doing, because I think even if you're not very tech-savvy, at some point you understand what an emulator is, in contrary to an arcade machine, and whether you play on an emulator or an arcade machine. I don't know.
It's my contrary opinion. I just don't care.
I mean, the thing is, do you really think, Brett, that Billy knows more than he would admit?
It seemed a little sus from what I've seen of the, you know, what I don't pay a ton of attention to it. I don't get down in the dirty details. Like AJ, I don't care that much. But it seems super important to these guys, these world record holders, it's a very ego-driven thing or something, or just that they want to make their mark. So it seems a little sus. Some of the stuff I've seen about Donkey Kong, I wouldn't entirely trust some of those scores by Billy.
Awesome. Yeah.
There's a lot of infighting amongst the Twin Galaxies group, you know, that the self-appointed, you know, keepers of the high scores. Mm-hmm. I've been saying for years now that there really needs to be somebody else doing it, because it's just, every time we talk to somebody, and we talk to, you know, we didn't have Billy Mitchell on the podcast. We've just talked to him elsewhere. And we did have Roy Schilt, which was an adventure. there's a lot of stuff. And then, but you talk to them, and they're perfectly reasonable people, and they have their opinions and whatever, they say it. But then you know, Jurg was saying beforehand, we had to turn commenting off on these things because people just show up out of nowhere like, oh, it's a fake interview or, you know, like because I think, you know, Roy Schilt was just audio. We didn't have video for him.
Exactly. So he wanted to use the phone.
Yeah, it's not really, it's not really him. Or, yeah, but there's a, you know, conspiracies to do this and that. It's like, dude, it's a Donkey Kong score.
Well, you know, for some people, it's pretty important because they're trying to, some people are trying to break it legitimately. And then, so for some people, you know, for some people, it's just as important as the World Series or the NBA Finals or something like that. So,
yeah.
Or the World Cup or whatever. So just, it, people take it pretty seriously. So, yeah. Mm. But in the end of the day, it's a high score in a kid's game.
Yeah. Right. So you've been covering the retro game scene for, you were saying like one of the books came out in 2007. So you've been around for a bit. What have you seen as like one of the
point? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've been writing professionally since 97, and then my first book came out a decade later. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So what have you seen like how has the retro scene kind of changed over the years? Because that's kind of something that really is it's such a different environment now than it was back in 96.
When I started. My gosh, it's really been incredible to watch the evolution of interest in retro gaming. So let's see. Okay, I'm going to go all the way back to 1983 because the crash, and in spring of 1983, before I saw games really getting discounted or anything, a friend of mine at school sold me his Atari 2600 and 10 games for $10. This was a major deal at that point because Ataris were still very expensive. It was you could not retro game
deal now.
At that point. That was a great deal. Yeah, it's still a great deal. But anyway, so yeah, that was an amazing deal. But that's what kind of made me start collecting because I was in some games, got an Atari 2600 in spring of 83. And then at that point, I was already starting to go to garage sales and flea markets and everyone. And I remember finding three ColecoVision games for $1 a piece, probably in 84. And in 83, I was 16. I had a job and a car, and I was going around all these different stores buying games from these massive discount bins during the crash. And so I kept collecting up through then. The early 90s, I discovered that there were other people like me that collected games, and that blew me away. I didn't think anybody cared about the Atari 2600 in 1991, 92, 93, but there was the Digital Press fanzine. There were some other fanzines like Atari 2600 Connection, Slapdash. There were several or quite a few other video game fanzines, just these fan-made magazines, sometimes just paper stapled together. Sometimes they were nicer than that. And I discovered that there were other collectors, and I discovered the Classic Gaming Expo in the early 2000s. My first one was 2003. There were stacks and stacks of, you know, brand new Atari 2600 games, at least, you know, new old stock, stacked up on tables, $2-$3 a piece. Some of the rare games at this point were, you know, going for $20 or so, complete in the box. It was known that there were a few super rare ones like Video Life and Chase the Chuck Wagon or whatever game for the 2600. So there was kind of a collector's market in the 90s, but it was super incredibly niche. This was a very, very small group of people that were, you know, because back then in the 90s and in the late 80s, once you got the new system, the old one went in the trash or to the Goodwill. Yeah,
they weren't retro yet. They were just old.
Yeah, just junk. A lot of people considered the previous, whatever generation they were in the mid-80s to the 90s, they just considered the previous generation junk. And so many, like a lot went up into the garage or the attic or the garage sale or the thrift store, but a ton of this stuff got thrown in the garbage. And hearing those stories, just like, you know, don't throw it away, do something with it.
That's exactly my feeling as well. Yeah.
I still have dreams of going to my old house and breaking into the attic to see if any of my stuff is still there.
Right. And but yeah, there's been some great attic finds. Even recently, there's been some great finds. And but yeah, in the 90s, and then the Digital Press website, there were forums on there where people were starting to connect and getting to know each other. The Immortal John Hancock was an early adopter of the Digital Press website, and some other familiar names were on the Digital Press website back in the 90s, and that just sort of this community just sort of grew. And then it really started snowballing 2006 with YouTube Angry Video Game Nerd, the Wii Shop channel, some older gamers starting to want to recapture their childhood. eBay kicked up in the late 90s. That started getting people looking, you know, looking for games they used to play.
I feel like that was also
snowballed from there.
I feel like eBay may have also been a big, because one of the reasons I stopped using my C64 back in, I think it was like 98 or 99, was mm-hmm. it was falling apart. The keyboard wasn't working. You know, all this stuff was going on. And I went to a friend of mine actually went to a thrift store and found a little Mac Classic. And so I got that.
Nice.
Today, I could go on eBay and find a replacement keyboard or another C64 for, you know, $100 and have right. it the next day, you know, but yes. that didn't exist at that point.
Yeah, pre-eBay, we were just, you know, I was just running around to thrift stores and pawn shops and stuff mm-hmm. looking for anything, you know, retro gaming related. And
right.
I would almost always, if I would map out a route from my house to all these different pawn shops and thrift stores, it would take me all day, you know, all around Dallas, Fort Worth, and Arlington. And I would always come back with stuff because it was available. It was cheap, dirt cheap. Garage sales are the same. I'd go with my parents to garage sales because that was something fun that we could do together and that we enjoyed. Even as an adult, I would go with them just because it was a nice activity we could enjoy together. And I would always come back with trash bags full of games. And I was reselling. I started eBay about a year after it started. And I was selling stuff even back then. And I would even go to Funkoland/GameStop a little later. And I would buy games from them. You know, they were pricing card only, CIB and sealed, all the same price. So if you had Legend of Zelda for $9.99, it'd be that way for the cart, for CIB, or a sealed one. And I did find a sealed one time. I sold on eBay for $80, which wow. would be worth a whole nice. Lot more now. And it was probably yeah. an early production copy.
Wow.
You
know,
all that. So, yeah, yeah. all that. I was reselling as early as the late 1990s. Just, you know, it'd be nice if I would have kept all that stuff, but who knew? You know, nobody right. in a million years. I've talked to a lot of different game collectors, a lot of the OGs, the guys that run the National Video Game Museum, the Immortal John Hancock, a lot of these guys that have been doing this as long or even longer than me. I've never talked to anyone that said, oh, yeah, I knew video games were going to be valuable like baseball cards and comic books. I knew that. None of them knew. Now, I knew a few right. people that would buy. A couple of people that said they have bought they would buy extras just because they were cheap or whatever, and they would just kind of have them. I don't know anybody that invested in them or that thought they would ever be valuable. Not a soul.
Right, right.
I mean,
right.
just I think just over the last 10 years, because I remember, you know, 2015, 2014 going on, and you could get, again, you get a C64 for, you know, $80, $100. Now they're, you know, $250, $300.
Yeah.
It's going up yeah. by the day, by the minute.
Yeah, it's gotten really crazy. If you look at some of the Saturn and Sega CD stuff, I used to, at Movie Trading Company, and this would be the, like, mid-2000s, Movie Trading Company, and even a little beyond that, they would sell all their Sega CD and Sega Saturn games for $3.99 each, no right. matter what it was. And so I built up a really nice Sega CD and Saturn collection, $4 a pop. And every once in a while, they would have something more than that. Somehow they knew something was right. ultra rare, and they might have it for 20 or 30. But typically 99%, 95% of their Sega CD stuff and Saturn stuff was $4. And same with 32X. And I think Web of Fire would be like $20 or something. It was really crazy. It was it's been fun watching this evolve. But at the same time, I've been like, you know, I should have bought. Right. You know, I remember seeing stacks of Sega 32X at Toys R Us when they blew those out for $9.99 yep. each. They couldn't get rid of them. And GameStop, they had stacks and stacks of Conker's Bad Fur Day, sealed, brand new N64. They blew them out yeah. for $9.99 at the end of the lifespan of that game, you know, being a new game. They were blowing them out. You know, they printed quite a few of those. They were blowing them out. And now, you know, sealed yeah. ones go for hundreds of dollars.
I was thinking the other day, you know, the small, like home run video stores. We got a Video Dens around here. They had the whole, you know, the whole video game section. And when they closed down, whenever that happened, when Netflix occurred, you know, all that stuff went for 99 cents.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, like,
I know
man.
A lot of people that, yeah, I know a lot of people that picked up a lot of the rare games in their collection, Earthbound, yeah. Chrono Trigger, whatever, just based on rental stores. My One find I remember is the Lone Ranger for the NES. Pretty hard one to find. I got that one CIB for $1.99 at a rental store that was just phasing out their NES games. That's just one of many examples. So much of my stuff I've resold over the years because I was, you know, to supplement writing it. You know, anybody that knows a writer that's not Stephen King or J.K. Rowling knows that supplemental income is always good.
Oh, yes.
And income that you can make without having to knock yourself out to come up with something to write and convince the publisher. When you can make a little money on the side selling stuff, it's a nice change mm-hmm. of pace from writing, and it's a nice supplemental income. So I was, you know, reselling just to do that. And I would even like Funcoland/GameStop. They would, some of their games were as low as 29 cents each up to, you know, they would have those little newspapers with the prices of all their games in them. Right. And they would have some as low as 29 cents. They would have everything. I don't know what system they were using, but I would buy all of, I'd buy up to 29 cent and 99 cent ones and go sell them at pawn shops, you know, for $3, $5 each, depending on which pawn shop would buy video games, you know, until they had too many of the Super Mario Duck Hunts, until they had too many of the super common ones. And then they thought, nah, we're cutting you off. Are the sport, are the Sega Genesis sports titles.
Mm-hmm.
But then now, yeah, I mean, video games are right where comic books were 20 plus years ago with stuff getting graded. And with where baseball cards were even before that, were the rare ones, the variant, the early variants, the first production copies, the ones that are sealed, the ones that are mint or whatever, they're just being, they're commodities. And the vast majority of games, 99% of them plus, aren't graded, aren't super valuable. So you can still, you know, buy the card only. You can still, you know, buy a Atari 2600 with 30 games for a reasonable price. You can still, there's still a lot of, you know, stuff from the 8 and 16-bit eras, card only, that you can still game for fairly cheaply. But yeah, but there's now another side of it where, you know, there's a serious collectibles market, which a lot of people kind of resent. And I kind of get it because a lot of us enjoyed the back in the day when you could go in and get CIB games for dirt cheap. But, you know, you can't live in the past, and that's just how it is.
Right.
Now.
Right.
I did a lot of my stuff.
Nothing can be done about it.
Yeah, I did a lot of my supplementary stuff.
You can hate it, but it's here to stay.
Yeah. I did a lot of my supplementary stuff with, I used to get like broken disk drives, Commodore disk drives, and I'd cobble together a working one to send that out. Because I was did the same thing. I was a freelance writer for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. I actually started as a programmer. I got real into programming on the C64.
And cool.
There was a magazine, Lodestar, that I submitted to, and I realized that I actually liked writing the documentation for the game more than I liked making the software.
Oh, cool.
So they published me. I was in 92. I was 14 years old.
Oh, excellent.
I was like, yeah, I want to do this.
That's great.
Yeah, it doesn't pay the bills.
Right. It's a great hobby.
It is, yes.
That's really cool. Were the Commodore 64 disk drives, were those kind of fragile? Because I used to go around to thrift stores all the time, and the keyboard would always work fine, and I could play cartridges, but I bought several disk drives and could never get them to work, so I just gave up.
They can be. If they get knocked around or if they, mm-hmm. they're left on for too long, the big guy I got down there, the 1541s, they could, your knows because he'll lecture you on how fragile they are.
Yeah, the problem is the power supply is in that the case and has very bad ventilation, so it will just overheat.
There are newer models. There's a 1541 that's got the power supply outside, which is similar to the little guy I've got above that, which is a different brand. It's
exactly
Enhancer 2000.
The 1541 too with the external power supply are more likely to survive. Yeah.
You also had both the mechanism inside because Commodore was famous for making things out of whatever parts happened to be laying around. So sometimes the mechanisms would be direct drive. Sometimes they were belt driven. If they're belt driven, that belt over time, you know, stretches and dries out. The direct drives, they're pretty solid no matter what, but I often have to replace the belts on half of the drives I work on because they just get old and they don't, you know, they run out of alignment and stuff.
Well, I gave up after three or four of them, and I mostly, I would collect computers just to use as consoles, like the TI-99, Commodore 64, Atari 800, VIC-20. I just collect them like consoles now, you know, with a bunch of cartridges.
The cool thing with what they're doing now is you can get so much cool new stuff for them. They make this It looks like a tiny disk drive, but it's an SD card reader. Works the same way. You know, it's the same commands on it and whatnot, but you know, instead of having 160K, you can have, you know, 16 gigs.
Right.
Which That's is cool. amazing.
Yeah. I never thought in a million years there'd be so much interest in this old tech, you know, all these years later.
Yeah, that's the other thing. What do you think about all the stuff that's being made? Because there's the old technology. Like, again, like this is my C64 from 1986. But right. I've got an SD card reader on it. It's got 16 megs of memory from, you know, in an RAM expansion. It's got all this stuff that I've added onto it that is now being made new for it.
I think it's incredibly cool, and it'll never stop blowing my mind that there's all these new games, new hardware, new peripherals being made for these old systems. Because, first of all, I never would have predicted it in a million years. Second of all, in 85, I think they officially canceled the ColecoVision in 85. I was devastated when the ColecoVision went away. You know, when they went, instead of doing the Super Game Module, they did the Atom Computer. Mm-hmm. I was super bummed out by that because I didn't care anything about computers back then. Right. And I just wanted the Super Game Module with all the levels, the, you know, better graphics and music, more music and the mm-hmm. animated cutscenes and all that stuff. And that was, right. I was super excited about that. And then they went to the Atom with all those, you know, glitches and everything. And it was the Atom bomb, big failure. But
yeah.
I was, you know, I wish I could have told my teenage self, hey, the ColecoVision is gone for now, but it's going to come roaring back later. And I've got my ColecoVision Phoenix hooked up to my, you know, big 72-inch TV. Mm-hmm. And I've got my, you know, with a Super Nintendo controller playing it and all these new homebrew games. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
It's like I'm sort of correcting a childhood mishap, you know. By, mm-hmm. You know, it's like the ColecoVision never went away. You know, it's pretty awesome.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I love the fact that you can do this. My Amiga 500 made in 1985. I'm on the web. Like, there's no sense. There's no reason this machine should be able to do that.
That's super cool.
But it's just the fact that it can, you know, like, right. Like I love this stuff. The fact that I can still use it for things, you know.
Absolutely.
For things today.
Yeah. And there's something about, like, each of the old consoles has a certain personality mm-hmm. when it comes to graphics. Like the Vectrex, the Odyssey 2, the ColecoVision, the Atari 2600. The graphical look, the sound, it all has its own personality. So when they make... You can't really recreate that on the Switch or whatever. So when you're actually playing it on a ColecoVision, you know, with the old joysticks and the old graphical style, it's just really, really cool. Really, it's really, it keeps me young.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I love the fact, too, that you can look at that. You can see that game pop up and you're like, Vectrex. Or like, you know, you know exactly what it is the second you look at it. I'm like, oh, that's Earth Tones. That's a Commodore 64 game. You know, exactly. It's all browns and greens.
And there's this amazing game called Vector Pilot. It's Time mm-hmm. Pilot for the Vectrex. And it's just a mind-blowingly great game. And it's like, mm-hmm. who would have thought in a million years when they were blowing out Vectrexes for $20 at KB Toys that all these years later somebody would be making mind-blowing games for this old system. So cool. And I love it. I just love the positive vibe of it, too. You know, the way the world is and the way it'll always be and always has been. There's so much crap that people are doing, mm-hmm. so much hate and stupidity and bigotry and all this stuff. You've got this really cool community that's by and large inclusive, working together on all these amazing projects with all this positivity and all this communal interest and everything. And yeah, I know there are segments of the gaming community, obviously with Gamergate and everything, there's a lot of problematic situations. That's because they're run by humans. Humans are apparently always going to be garbage. But
wow,
there's a large segment of the retro gaming community that's incredibly cool, that does incredible projects, that works together on all these super interesting and fun activities, make life fun and creates this great community. I've met so many good friends through retro gaming and stuff that it's just incredibly cool.
I'd go so far as to even say it's probably the vast majority of people are awesome. It's a very, the people that suck are a very vocal minority. They're very loud, but there's only a few of them.
Yeah, maybe 5%. I don't know.
Yeah.
2%. Something. Mm-hmm. It's a small minority because the vast majority of us are just looking to have a good time and hang out.
Right.
I wonder, by the way, what's your opinion about those youngsters I mean,
there's a youngster's word again. He keeps saying, yeah, we're not that old.
I remember when I started Scene World, the disc magazine, 24 years ago, everybody was telling me I was too young with my 18 years of age to be knowledgeable about the Commodore 64. And just last year, we interviewed Kelsey Lewin, who was 27 at that time, and she knows a lot about NES games and stuff. So basically, she is concentrating on on games and consoles that were built before she was even born. Mm-hmm. So I wonder, what's your opinion about those? Because when I watch a few YouTubers in their 20-something years of age, and they get so much facts wrong about those old video games, I'm like, boy, seriously. Or calling the Super NES.
Super NES. Okay, you're North American.
I'm not North American.
I'm talking to Brett. You're of North America, as am I. Did you call it Super Nintendo or did you call it SNES?
I never called it SNES, and nobody, and none of us called it that. And I knew people that did, but it always sounded wrong.
I never heard it until a couple of years ago when we were talking to somebody. I'm like, SNES? The hell is SNES?
Yeah, we never called it the NES either.
No.
Yeah, it was always the NES or the Nintendo.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. You're like the one person that agrees with me on this so far.
Yeah, I think it's incredibly cool that young people are interested in retro gaming history. A lot of the books I sell are to young people that are interested in the history of games they've never played, or they want to know more about them, or they're collecting, or wanting to put together a set, or they want to find out what games are actually fun to play. So they'll get my books. And I think it's cool. I did talk to Kelsey about that, and she's faced ageism, you know, discrimination based on her age, and she's gotten some nasty comments based on her age. But
I never asked her that. Is that so? Okay.
Yeah. She said she's experienced more ageism than sexism.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of gatekeepers that think, you know, they're the keepers of the secret knowledge or whatever, and don't think anybody should dispense this knowledge if you're over a certain age, which is ridiculous. If you think about it, nobody writing about the Civil War today was alive then.
Right.
So, you know, you can be a very educated person on vintage video games and be a very young person. And just as long as you do your research, and if a young person gets something wrong because they weren't around then, that's when, you know, you just politely point out, hey, you know, it was actually this way, you know, not this way.
You're wrong.
Yeah, I mean, we're three guys in their late 20s that know all about this stuff. So, absolutely.
Right, exactly.
I mean, honestly, those will be the people that are still around in, I don't know, 50 plus years.
Yeah, they'll need to carry this information forward.
Exactly. Yeah. If we don't encourage younger people to do that, then nobody will, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have no problem with younger people picking up the mantle or being interested in this stuff. I think it's incredibly cool. And it's just ridiculous and gatekeepery to try to scoreboard young people trying to figure all this stuff out. And then they do get some stuff wrong. They don't know what, you know, retro or like vintage, you know, arcades of the early 80s, late 70s. They don't know what they were really like because they didn't live through them. But they can read about it. They can learn. Right. And, you know, it's talking to people like me that live through this stuff. They can glean information from it, or reading some deep dive articles, going through and looking at old magazines, old books and everything, and get an idea of what the culture was then. Yeah, I say books. There weren't that many books on video. Back then, most video game books were about tips and tricks and hints and strategies. There were a few books on the cultures of gaming, but very, very few.
Right.
Anyway, yeah, young people, it's awesome. You go, young people.
You know, people like you have built up a great repertoire because you've got, you know, the books, you've got the YouTube videos that go into a lot of stuff. There's a lot of, you know, and that's something that I feel like a lot of us in this scene are kind of trying to do, is sort of create a repository of, you know, where we can put this stuff, and it'll be there for however long YouTube exists. so that you know, it'll so that when we're gone,
a lot of this with the books, a lot of time, like I in my omnibus books, I have what I call notable quotables. Mm-hmm. They're quotes from other sources, like old magazines that are lost to time that people don't really go back and look at much, or they're from websites that were once very prominent or may still be prominent, but that won't necessarily always be there. So right. to have them in print is kind of a good thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry.
No, carry on.
I just want to say, because they said, as long as YouTube is still around, we had an interview with the Internet Archive, and they told us that behind the curtain, they are having an archive ready for the day when YouTube is going down. So that's being taken care of, actually.
Get sued by Google now for that.
I mean, they said it in our podcast, so the word is already out.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
So probably whenever Google decides to shut down YouTube, there will be a backup, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, well, hopefully somebody will buy it or something. The videos won't all be erased or something.
I mean, even when you talk to people that were around in those early gaming years, sometimes people remember facts wrong. And well, so
human nature. History,
and then history is rewritten in a wrong way. I mean, there has been examples where composers don't remember that they had written the music for a certain game 40 plus years ago. I wrote that. I don't remember. You know, so
right.
Yeah.
It was just a job. Other issue. In a lot of cases, it was just a job, and they never thought they'd have to think about it again.
Right. Exactly. And that's also another thing that is very, very sad, and that we should tackle, I believe. Quite a few people that we interviewed were just saying, no, it's past, and I don't want to talk about it anymore. And I'm always thinking, like, man, you probably have so much stuff and stories to tell from the 80s and 70s and 90s, and you don't want to talk about it? That's such a loss for society. That's just
they may not realize how many people are interested. They may not know there's a significant retro gaming community.
Right.
Yeah, well, that was the case with
Dave Lowe.
Yes, Dave. Thank you, Dave Lowe. Yeah, he didn't. People were looking for him for years. He didn't have any idea that he was famous musician.
I looked for him 12 years.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, not just you. Other people did too. You found him, but other people were looking for him, and he didn't have any idea that he was this like celebrity for years. He'd been a celebrity. You know, it was this big revelation.
Something similar happened with comic books in the 70s and 80s. There was these comic conventions that would reach out to actors from the 30s and 40s that were in these serials or these low-budget science fiction movies in the 50s, and they had no idea anybody knew who they were. And they were just, minds were blown when they would be flown out to these conventions, and they might sell their autograph photo for $5 each, and they were just, they could not believe people knew who they were or what they were in. Right.
Yeah, it's
that's exactly. But hey, now we are talking to you, Brett. You know that you are important.
Yeah. I don't know about that. I'm important to my dog.
Well, that's all that counts, you know. That's...
Yeah, I mean. It's always important to have somebody writing about those stuffs and making the connections. And I also noticed when doing those interviews here, it's also good to have a story shed a light on from different sides, because people have different opinions about the same subject. And it's helping a lot to have it from a couple of sides, right? Mm-hmm. But I also understand that, as we mentioned earlier, for some people it's really important that everything goes right and they can make a buck out of it and stuff, right? So I also know that a lot of people that are into the retro business are also in it only just because you can make money out of it. You know, you can see that, for example, when you look at some sellers on eBay and they don't really care to make something clean before they make photos, you know, and they will like super rare NES game. And they will write adult owned or something. And then you see like torn off labels and like brownish cola like spots on the cartridge. I'm like, man, I wouldn't even dare to touch that because I couldn't.
Yeah, anytime there's a big, anytime something catches fire, like the retro gaming thing, there's going to be people hopping on board and not knowing what they're doing and not really interested in the subject and trying to make a buck off of it.
Right, right. And I know I bought Pro Protector, which in Germany is the censored version of Turrican, right? For the Game Boy. And it turned out that it was a pirated fake cartridge. And there was a different game on it, Sokoban. And I'm like, I don't need Sokoban, I want Pro Protector. And the seller was like, can you keep it if I sell it to you for $5 less? I'm like, no, it's worth nothing. You sold me the wrong thing. I want my money returned. I sent you back your item and I get my money returned. But people don't get it. People sometimes think that I'm just buying it for, I don't know, for the cupboard to look at or something, not really to use it, to play it, to experience the game. It's like those discussions with some eBay sellers are so exhausting sometimes, you know?
I'm sure. A lot of people are selling through Facebook Marketplace these days.
Yeah.
Because there's no fees and you might get a little more accurate descriptions and stuff.
And that's a good hint.
Pick up locally and stuff. Yeah.
That's a good hint. Yeah. So sometimes I'm like, man, why are you even selling it if you have no idea, you know? Or another trend that also pisses me off a lot is when people are writing untested on it. Yeah. I'm like, man, you are having this computer, you are having the tape drive, you're having the disk drive. You can just put it in and load. And no, just write untested.
Yeah.
Like, why? You know?
Because and they sometimes do that, then they have to tell you it doesn't work.
And sometimes they don't even rewind the tape. So you end up that the game is broken because it in the middle of the tape there is a dent because they didn't rewind it before shipping. Mm-hmm. I'm like, no. I'm like, no, man. I don't know if you experienced that, Brad, but that's something that sometimes I'm like, holy moly, no.
Yeah, I haven't really bought anything on eBay in quite some time, but most of my eBay purchases have been pretty reliable.
But okay.
It's been a while.
So I'm seeing on the description of your classic home video games series. There's mm-hmm. there's a couple of books. I think there's three. Is that right?
Yeah, three. Yeah.
So this covers, it says, you know, it covers Adventure Vision, APF, MP1000, the Arcadia 2001, Astrocade, Atari 2600, 5200, 7800, ColecoVision, the Fairchild Channel F that we were talking about before, Intellivision, the Microvision, Odyssey, Odyssey 2, RCA Studio 2, Telstar Arcade, and Vectrex. The next one covers, good lord, the NES, the 7800, the Sega Master System, that was my best game from that was a snail in the maze game you got if you didn't put a cartridge in when you turn it on.
Right.
And then after that, there's the 16-bit, the Neo Geo, the Genesis, the TurboGrafx-16. Are there any that aren't listed here that you cover?
That's pretty – it covers the U.S. market. And, I didn't include the Atari XE. Like, there's a few games created for that aren't necessarily computer games. They're created specifically for that, you know, the console version of the Atari 800 or whatever. But yeah, it's comprehensive. It's all the games for all the pre-NES systems. And I was going to do a fourth volume covering mm-hmm. Super Nintendo, LaserActive, Jaguar, 3DO, CDI, and all that stuff. But I started doing the omnibus books instead. The market was just headed that way, and I didn't want to there were so many CD-i games and 3DO games that I didn't really have access to, and that I didn't even want to bother playing, and I just didn't want to deal with. So I sort of ended it at three volumes, and some people will still say they want a fourth Classic Home Video Games volume because they just like the simple format capsule about every game. But so far, I haven't really. Maybe a retirement project, I don't know. But so far, right now, it's just at three volumes. And hopefully, I don't know. People are enjoying the omnibus books. And I was going to do a Sega Genesis omnibus, but Sega UK shut down a couple of book projects.
Oh, really?
After they'd already, one of them had already been completed. And so they had to give away the PDF for free, which was just heartbreaking for the author of the book and everything. So I kind of stalled that project, and I just need to reach out to Sega, you know, to USA division to see if a book like this would be, you know, because they just shut them down. You know, their lawyers went after them, and people say that sounds like something Nintendo would do.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah.
That's what everybody tells me, but whatever reason, those two book projects got shut down, and it kind of scared me off.
Because we had a thing a couple years ago on the C64 where somebody did a they did a almost code just ported it from Super Mario Brothers from the NES to the C64 like straight up. It looks exactly the same.
Yeah.
And Nintendo made them take it down. And someone did the same thing, similar thing anyway, not code, not an exact copy of it, but it's, you know, it plays and is the same thing as Sonic. And Sega was just like, cool.
Yeah,
you know, that's it was a totally different, you know, like Nintendo was like, how dare you? And Sega was like,
yeah,
great. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a specific thing with Sega UK or what. I haven't really investigated it, you know, so.
But it's actually true what AJ says. I mean, this is how Sonic Mania in 2017 came about. Sega was actually approaching that hobby project like, hey, do you want us to work with you and make this a full-fledged commercial release? So this is actually how that happened. And
that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And so now, and then the omnibus, you know, I'm looking at, I have the NES omnibus on my screen right now. I'm looking at it. There's two volumes of that. And that encompasses a lot of games. That's not every game that was released.
It's every U.S. release.
Every U.S. release,
Yeah, at the back of Volume 2, you've got the foreign releases for the NES. Mm. Not the Famicom games, but the ones that were foreign releases for the NES. So, yeah, it's comprehensive for the NES.
Awesome. That's amazing. Yeah, does it include only the approved by Nintendo, or does it have some of the, like, the ones that came in the light blue cartridge?
Oh, it's got those two. Yeah, nice. It's got the 6-in-1, the all those crazy... Bubble Bath Babes and all those unlicensed game stuff. So yeah, it's comprehensive. Oh, amazing.
Yeah. That is awesome.
Thank you.
I mean there were even some big titles being unlicensed for the NES. Think about Afterburner, Tetris, for example.
Yeah. Was that
one? Tetris. You know, Tengen did an unlicensed Tetris for the NES, but Nintendo has their version too.
Right, exactly. Right. Yes, and the Tengen version actually of Tetris is even available on the arcade. So
it's got two player split screen on the Tengen one.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, you are the expert sitting right there, so of course you know, right? Yeah. Yes.
So where can people find your books? Where can they follow along, see the videos, buy the books?
I'm going to keep it simple. If you just go to brettweisswords.com, see my name here, Brett Weiss, brettweisswords.com. Mm-hmm. There's links to my books. You can buy directly. There's links to Amazon. There's links to my YouTube channel and all that good stuff. So, yeah, you can check it out.
Awesome.
Subscriptions to Amazon. YouTube subs are always, you know, click on subscribe. Much appreciated. You don't even have to buy a book if you don't want. You can just subscribe to my channel. Or if you want a retro gaming book, you can do that as well.
Awesome.
I'm actually going to get one. And you have the option on there. I'm looking at it. You can get it for, you can get the book, or you can get the book autographed.
Yeah. You can. I'll be happy to sign any books I send out.
And I think it's the same price for both, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which is kind of amazing, because usually, you know, a lot of places are like, yeah, you can get an autograph for $20 more.
Yeah, a lot of people will upcharge, but I thought, you know... I'm no big deal.
I mean, you
it's
got
not
your...
that hard for me just to write my name. I don't mind. You know, I'm happy to do it.
I mean, you got your Todd Rogers signature for free.
There you go. Yeah.
I ended up. So the guy that bought the Dragster cartridge from me, Darren Peliquin, that directed Bits of Yesterday, that video game documentary, actually ended up writing the foreword for the Blu-ray. Like, if you open the Blu-ray and you see there's a like a cardboard thing with, you know, about the movie, I wrote the foreword for that. So, you know, it's a small little, it's a small world.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, that is nice. Great. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my grandfather always used to say, those people that are rude to you, it will bite back at some point in the future in their life. So.
So there's, yeah, it's generally a good idea to kind of be nice to people because it won't come back and bite you, you know. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Sounds good, man. Appreciate it.
Beautiful.
Talk to you then.
Right. Thank you, sir.
Bye.
All right. See you later.
Thank you.